You both ready? Will the clerk please call the case?
Court will now call the State of Texas versus Nathan A. Marks. May we support Mr. Matthew J. Whitney will argue for the state. Mr. Chris Abel will argue for the appellate.
May proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. Before I get started, I do need to correct a mistake I've made in my brief. If you look on page 16, where I'm talking about the third factor in the Barker analysis in this case, and it is clearer in the statement of facts earlier, but I did say that his first assertion of his speedy trial right actually came in the form of a motion to dismiss. That's actually not correct. He filed two settings on his first assertion of speedy trial right, then asserted it another time later, and then later filed a motion to dismiss for violation of speedy trial right. But I do want to make sure that's clear to the court, and I apologize for that mistake. But while we're there, I do believe that the Cantu and Palmer cases are still applicable to this case when we're talking about the analysis here. Appellee was arrested, and it was over a year, well over a year, before his first assertion of a speedy trial right in November of 2015. He was arrested 6-7 months passed before complaint and information were filed. During that time, there was no assertion of a speedy trial right. And then at that point, court had a docket. There was, Appellee reset an announcement, made a reset. There were a couple of delays that were on Appellee's delays in the case. And then sometime around July.
Are those the delays that had to do with the fact that he was in federal custody by then, or were these different delays?
These are before he was ever arrested. Okay. On that federal issue. And then in, I believe, July of 2015 or so, he was somehow brought into federal custody on that issue. And even then, it wasn't until November of 2015 that he first asserted a right to a speedy trial. Now, at that point, there is, and as Appley has pointed out, an email, Defendant's Exhibit 3, in which one of the trial prosecutors said, well, we're not sure it's our responsibility to bring him back for trial. If you read Barker and Smith v. Hawley, it is the state's responsibility to bring bring a person who's in custody back from trial. But what the record shows, even if it was not initially done through using the writ process, that the state cooperated with this every step of the way. At every point, getting ready for trial, the state had subpoenas ready. There was no point at which the state was not ready to have the trial. But what the record seems to indicate...
The state was ready, but they didn't have the defendant there.
No, the defendant was not there.
And that would not be fair to proceed without the defendant, don't you agree?
Of course.
So it's a little bit disingenuous to say they did everything they could do, since it was their responsibility to make sure that he got there.
Why didn't the state try to writ this gentleman out of federal custody? Why didn't the state attempt to writ this gentleman out of federal custody?
The state did attempt in a mistaken way. What I believe, and why I don't think our argument is disingenuous, respectfully, Your Honor, is this. The state attempted to use bench warrants at first, and that appears from the record to be what the trial court wanted, the defense wanted. The defense requested the bench warrants. The state signed off on the bench warrants. The trial court signed off on the bench warrants. And what appears to have happened is that nobody understood apparently they, what they needed to happen was to file a writ.
But that's the state's responsibility, not the trial court or the defendant, right?
Yes.
So how do we deal with that, the fact that the judges in this case and the state didn't know the proper procedure to get the individual out of federal custody?
I think it just needs to factor into the four-part analysis. And yes, that weighs against our position here. It was the state's responsibility, apparently, to file the writ. But what the analysis shows in totality, Your Honor, is that most of the delay in this appellee's trial, well over a year of it, is attributable to the appellee and is weighed against him. And even though the state used, after that, an improper method at first to get the appellee back, there's no prejudice to the appellee in this case. There was no evidence that the appellee suffered any. I'm sorry.
So you don't buy what the appellee is saying about how the pendency of this proceeding delayed his getting into some sort of rehab program?
No, Your Honor. And in fact, if you look at our objections to the trial court's findings of fact and conclusions of the law, you'll notice, and if you read the record of the hearing, the appellee's own testimony, what it appears is that even if he'd got the BOP program and all these things in the federal case, he still would have had to serve 85% of his time in that case. And so it's not at all clear that the delay in this trial increased any amount of time he would have had to spend in custody. And so it's, and in addition to that, there's no evidence that this delay affected his ability to present a defense in this case. No evidence in the record at all. And so that prejudice prong gets to the point of what we're saying, which is that dismissal of the case was too drastic a remedy.
Well, so I'm sorry. Does the prejudice that a defendant must show for a violation of a speedy trial right, is it required that it be prejudiced in the actual case, or can it be more generalized?
I believe that the case law says it can be more generalized than just in that case. For instance, if he had suffered some prejudice to his federal case, then yes, that would weigh in the analysis against the state. But if you look at the evidence, like I was saying in this case, it's not at all clear that it did. In fact, it probably didn't.
But don't we have to defer to the trial court in deciding that?
Well,
the trial court weighed the factors, and don't we defer to the trial court's fact-finding?
Yeah, we do. The court does defer to the trial court's fact-finding. And again, the state made objections to those, timely objections under the rules to the findings that were made, pointing out the areas in which the record seems clear to not bear out what the trial court's findings were. And so if those findings are an abuse of discretion, then no. This court does not necessarily have to just blindly follow the findings that the trial court made. I do want to also point out that, I already covered that, the delay. I don't really have a whole lot more to present unless there are more questions. There's only one issue in this case. So are there any more questions? Well, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Chris Abel. I'm from Flower Mound. Thank you for having me down here today. I represent Mr. Marks. We are asking that you affirm the court's decision dismissing the case for violation of his speedy trial rights. I'd like to address just a few things. I think the first prong of Barker-Wingo is not really in dispute. The length of delay here is pretty well settled. It's beyond what was necessary to make our threshold showing. And so I'd like to concentrate on the other factors, if I may.
Before you get into that, may I ask you about the state's contention that the first year of the delay was basically your client's fault?
Yes, ma'am. Even prior to filing, a defendant can assert their right to a speedy trial. It may be difficult with a formal motion since there's no filing of a case at that point, but there have been cases where defendants have written letters Council's made phone calls to try to get cases filed quicker and things like that, and courts have said that even if you're not indicted or a case isn't filed, you can still try to assert your right. And there is no evidence that he did prior to the case being filed.
Must a defendant assert that sort of right?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and no court has recognized and said that this is your deadline by which you must assert your right. And if we were to even throw out all of that time that elapsed prior to his first assertion of the right, which took place in November 2015, and just started our timeline there, it's still almost a year until he gets to the Denton County Jail and they have this hearing, which we could, I guess, call his trial date. It's still almost a year, which is well beyond the threshold requirement to trigger a Barker versus Wingo analysis. So if we look at that and we look at his assertions, first one takes place in November 2015, and he files a motion for a speedy trial setting. Trial court agrees to it and grants it. He files another one later on down the road, and then he files three attempts to get a bench warrant, basically saying, I want to resolve my case. I want to get to Denton County. Please help me out, state. And the state doesn't do that. And what's telling is that the state said in their email specifically to his trial counsel, we are not going to help you in this process. We're not going to file anything. This is your job to get your client here, as if somehow trial counsel has a badge, a gun, an armed transport to get somebody out of federal custody into the Denton County Jail. They specifically chose not to do that, and that weighs greatly against the state, because that's not just mere negligence, that's not just a crowded docket or too many cases being handled on a certain day or anything like that. That's because they chose not to do it. And there was a stipulation entered into at the time of this hearing, and the trial court's findings of fact reflect this, that the state, this particular DA's office, knew how to do this and knew how to get an inmate here. They had done it on felonies before. They had done a writ of pro sequendum to get someone there from federal custody on a felony. They just hadn't really done it on misdemeanor.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. I mean, is there anything in the record to suggest that the state might in good faith have believed that a writ of pro sequendum was only used for felonies and a bench warrant would work for a misdemeanor? I mean, had that been done before?
There's nothing in the record either way, Your Honor. It could have just been a matter of not asking the right person in the office. It could be as simple as that. I don't know.
Thank you.
But we have a valid assertion. We have almost a year that elapses with no effort by the state until magically after my client files his motion to dismiss for violation of speedy trial. Then 3 or 4 days later, now the state has gone and walked the halls and talked to everybody they need to and found out we need to do a writ of pro sequendum. And that's when the writ is first generated. And they get him there 6 weeks later, something like that, they get him to the Denton County Jail.
And the prosecutor's office communicated that it's not our problem, it's yours. Was there any pushback on that? Was there a hearing, discussion, or anything that took place to flesh out that contention, or did it just get dropped until the next setting and it was dropped? And
there's nothing else in the record, Your Honor. The only other thing, there's an email from another prosecutor to trial counsel for Appalee, wherein they say, hey, if you want to plea in absentia, we'll allow you to do that. But no further hearings are conducted with regards to the state being unwilling.
And the defense didn't come back and counter and say, no, actually, it's your obligation to do it. Go do it.
The defense did file motions for bench warrants saying, please issue a bench warrant in this case to try to get me here. Mm-hmm. So the defense did put forth some effort to still try to get to Denton County to get that trial done. But there's nothing in the record, any kind of order or mandate from the trial court to get the DA's office to file the proper paperwork, and there's no hearing regarding that as well. But what we have here under that prong from Barker versus Wingo, under the reason for delay, the second prong, we have basically the inability of the state to justify that delay after the assertion, and in a deliberate attempt to delay that by simply saying, we're not going to help you at all by filing anything, which is straight out of the Munoz case, which basically says that a deliberate attempt to delay a trial is weighed heavily against the state. And this was deliberate. We see that from the email. We see no effort to do the proper writ until 4 days after the motion to dismiss is filed. So the reason here being that this office even knew how to do this proper writ weighs heavily against the state. The defendant made multiple assertions for that right to a speedy trial. Like we mentioned earlier, if we threw out that prior time in which he had not invoked his right and we just don't even calculate that, we still have enough time to have a speedy trial violation. It's still almost a year after his first assertion and the time they get him to Denton County all of which time he's filed two motions for special for trial, speedy trial settings, three requests for bench warrants, trying to get there to Denton County to resolve the issue. As far as prejudice goes, this court gives great deference to the trial court's findings of fact that were done after this hearing, and this trial judge found both Appellee and Appellee's father, who testified regarding prejudice in this case, to be credible. That credibility finding was made. It's in the record by the trial court. And the trial court found that there was prejudice here because my client was delayed in getting into a rehabilitation program in federal custody. Had he been able to get in there without this pending state charge denying him that access, he would have gotten out earlier. It added to his length of confinement in federal custody. Furthermore, he is served from the time we look at when the warrant is issued, when he NICEized back in August of 2015 and a warrant is issued, he is in custody. He serves more than the maximum sentence for this charge. By the time we get to October and his case is dismissed, he's done more than a year. And that's the max sentence he would have had if he had been found guilty and got rung up by a jury. Short of a fine, there's nothing more the state of Texas could have done to this man. He has served his time and gone beyond that. So the prejudiced element is met there by certainly the length of extension of his incarceration in federal custody. He served more than the maximum punishment allowed under state law, and not to mention the anxiety and the angst that's caused by being held and not having any resolution to this case despite at least five attempts to get there and resolve it. The Court of Criminal Appeals in Turner v. State, a 1986 case, found that just because someone's in federal custody doesn't mean they can't be prejudiced by a state hold. They can be. They can be denied parole status, trustee status. All of those things are still cognizable as prejudice to a defendant.
But do you have to prove those? Is that part of your proof? Do we just assume that?
Well,
because there's no real evidence of that in this case.
Proof of actual prejudice isn't really required when the delay is excessive. And that's from the Shaw case, a Court of Criminal Appeals case from 03. And here we have that. Furthermore, the Cantu case specified that when you have bad faith on the side of the state, you really have to show less prejudice when you're on the defense side in a Barker versus Wingo analysis because of the reason for the delay. And we have that here, basically the state dragging their feet. But we did meet that burden. Two witnesses testified at this evidentiary hearing. The trial court found them to be credible and made findings of fact that show a prejudice. So that burden was definitely met within several factors. When we look specifically to prejudice, three potential prongs there: oppressive pretrial incarceration, anxiety, concern, and concern beyond what is normal for being charged with an offense, and impairment to the defense. So those are three possible areas in which someone could show harm or prejudice. And we certainly met the first one, oppressive pretrial incarceration. He served beyond his maximum sentence. Anxiety and concern beyond the norm. He testified to that. Trial court found it to be so. An impairment to his defense. There are several questions alluding to it in the record. There was an objection lodged by the state for relevance. It was ultimately sustained and no offer of proof made. So I really can't speak to impairment to defense in this case. But those three prongs work independently of each other. And certainly we met two out of the three. Plus, when you look at Shaw and when you look at Cantu, because of the acts of the state and dragging their feet and not bringing this man through a writ to Denton County, we really don't have to show a whole lot of prejudice. But even if we did, we're still there. We've served beyond the maximum sentence, and we couldn't get into a federal rehab program, which lengthened our federal incarceration. So certainly those things are there. Even absent records from the federal government backing that up, that testimony is still on the record, and the trial court found it to be credible, and that deserves great deference. I don't believe the trial court abused its discretion in any way by making those findings. It certainly was there for the trial court to decide whether to believe it or not believe it, and the trial court did and found the evidence to be credible. So that prejudice to defendant prong under Barker versus Wingo is certainly met. If there are no more questions, I'll yield back the time to appellate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's nothing in the record here to demonstrate any bad faith on the part of the state. If the record's anything, it's somewhat ambiguous as to who, if anyone involved at the trial court level, knew whether a writ was supposed to be filed.
But bad faith isn't a component of the speedy trial rights violation, is it?
Counsel alluded to if there is bad faith on the part of the state in these situations, that the prejudice standard is a bit turned upside down on its head. And what I'm trying to get across is that there's nothing in the record to demonstrate any bad faith here.
It was, at best, I think we see in the record that the prosecutor was mistaken, but didn't go back and check to make sure that their mistaken belief, never went back and verified that their position was a correct one. In fact, it was not correct, and they stood on an incorrect. So it may not have been bad faith, but it was an erroneous position to take that was taken on more than one occasion.
And if it was negligent, then that weighs into the analysis.
But it's repeated. It's not just one time they said it's not my problem.
Well, and
they
repeatedly said that even when they did file the writ, the feds ignored the first one.
When you actually did file the writ, rather. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about the bench warrant. I apologize, counsel.
Oh, no. There were two writs, Your Honor. So, in the end analysis, the question becomes, was dismissal even the appropriate remedy? Even if the trial right was not speedily hastened, well, he was back, so give him his trial.
Is Mr. Abel correct that the defendant had already been in custody longer than the maximum sentence he could have received?
He had been in federal custody, and he was finally brought back from federal custody just shortly before the motion to dismiss for this case came to the court's docket. He wasn't in custody on these charges.
Different crime he's being charged with.
Yeah.
Right.
And again, there's his own testimony in the case was it makes it not at all clear whether he suffered any further federal time or any prejudice to that case. And so in the end, the question really is, was dismissal the appropriate remedy? And our position is that no, it was not. And once he was back, they should give him his trial. And what ended up happening is that the appellee ends up getting arrested on other charges and now gets a windfall and escape from justice on this charge.
Well, let me ask you this, and it didn't happen in this case, but what if the delay had been not just the period of time we're talking about here, but let's say it had been 5 or 10 years delay? Is it still not appropriate to dismiss it? Are you saying that because of the facts? Or are you saying that in any case dismissal is not the appropriate remedy?
I think it has to be. I think it's highly fact specific, which is why we have a four pronged analysis. But in a case like that, my answer would be, a lot of it depends on what's the prejudice to the instant defense.
If he's missed a speedy trial, he's missed a speedy trial.
Yes.
So whether he's missed it by a year or missed it by 10 years, isn't dismissal the right way to go?
In this case, no, because the remedy was he was back. We figured it out and filed a writ.
What if it was 10 years though? Would the remedy still be you get your trial now, albeit not speedy?
Again, I think that changes a whole other. In that case, it would change a whole other set of facts on the other factors of analysis. For instance, prejudice to the instant defense, witnesses not being available because it was 10 years later, things like that. So it would. We can't just change one fact in isolation. But if we did, I suppose I would concede the point, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your time. Thanks for having us down here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, your case has been submitted. You're now free to head back north.